Welcome to Home Ground. I'm Brian Kahn. Just about all of us feel we support and value the United States Constitution, and most of us would say the same about Montana's. But the fact is that most of us haven't read those documents, at least in a long time. So we don't really remember what they say or how their provisions impact real life. But if you're a justice on Montana's Supreme Court, you do know those provisions. Because on a regular basis, when people disagree about what they mean, you are called upon to decide. In tonight's program, we're going to discuss the job and some of the real-life decisions with Beth Baker, Justice of the Montana Supreme Court. Justice Baker, many thanks for joining us on Home Ground again.
Many thanks for having me.
Now, the last time you were here, you were a candidate. How's the job turned out for you? Any surprises?
Well, I'm now a little over a third of the way into my fourth year, and I would say that the job is everything I expected and more in many ways. A few surprises.
What's the more part? Let's start with that.
The more is the steadiness and volume of the workload. I always knew as a practicing lawyer that the Montana Supreme Court had a lot going on, but I didn't fully appreciate the sheer volume of work that the court deals with on a weekly basis. We do have statistics from our most recently completed year, which was 2013, and we had approximately 860 filings, and those include everything from direct appeals to writs from prisoners and people who are seeking a review of a case while it's still in the middle of the district court trial, also attorney discipline matters. It's a wide range, but over 860 total filings. In the direct appeals, we issued 380 written opinions.
So that's more than one a day. And these are not typically simple cases to decide.
And in some cases, they don't always involve complex areas of law, but they always involve real disputes between people with a record that we have to review from the trial court. So regardless of the legal issues, there are always cases that parties have brought before the courts for resolution that require review by the court of the record to make sure that they were treated fairly and to decide whether or not the district court made any legal mistakes.
People know from general reading that there are often disagreements on the bench between justices, whether it's the Montana Supreme Court or the United States Supreme Court. Of the opinions issued, I think you said 380. Roughly how many have a split opinion?
Of those 380 last year, there were actually dissenting opinions in only 30 of those, so that's only 8%. The vast majority of cases the court is unanimous on.
When I think of the United States Supreme Court, they have clerks that do a lot of the legal research and I assume some of the draft writing. Does the Montana court have that?
Yes. Each justice has two law clerks, and they are, in my case, pretty new lawyers. They've graduated recently from law school, and they assist immensely with research and review of the record, putting together summaries, finding cases that bear on the issues that the court is being asked to decide, and working on draft opinions. The advantage in my view of having young people is they're fresh out of law school. They have been mired in court opinions for the last 3 years. They know what a good court opinion looks like. They know when it's confusing, and they're excited about the law. They're eager to learn and research, and I really enjoy having them.
Now, there are 7 justices in the Montana Court?
Well, presently there are only 6 because we have a vacancy.
You mentioned surprises, a few surprises. What?
Another surprise for me was the number of cases that come before the Montana Supreme Court without lawyers. Last year, about 37% of all of our filings involved at least one party who was not represented by a lawyer.
I know the idea of what isn't called pro se is that people ought to be able to represent themselves and save money.
It's not just about saving money. It's about being unable to afford legal assistance. From the court standpoint, we still have an obligation to make sure those cases are reviewed thoroughly. So we have the handbook with guidelines for people to represent themselves. We research the issues they raise to make sure that we understand the law, even if people aren't adequately presenting the law. And we do our best to give everybody a level playing field on both sides of every case. We've also just started a new program for pro bono assistance in some of these cases, which means that we have lawyers who have volunteered to draft briefs, but we don't just have that on a basis where litigants can request it. If the court looks at a case involving a self-represented litigant and decides that the issues are more complicated and need additional briefing, we can refer one of those cases to the pro bono appellate program and make sure both sides have counsel to advocate the issues.
You're listening to Home Ground, and I'm Brian Kahn. We are talking with Montana Supreme Court Justice Beth Baker, and we're about to talk about specific provisions of the Constitution and how the court wrestles with them. I think most of us tend to think of the Constitution as a fairly short, clear document and wonder why so many cases seem to end up with a court interpreting what the words mean. What would you say to people that say, well, why don't we just let it speak for itself?
Well, there are provisions in the Constitution that are simple and clear, but there are others that, by their very words, call for the exercise of judgment, such as the right to due process or the right to be free from unreasonable searches and seizures. Those are words that require judgment by definition. What is reasonable? What is unreasonable?
Mm-hmm.
And there are other examples where legitimate disputes can be raised about how those words should be applied in a given situation.
Let's start with the case, the Billings Gazette versus the City of Billings, and it pits Montana's explicit right to privacy with the public's explicit right to know, two provisions in the Constitution.
Those are common provisions of our Constitution that come into conflict. Article 2, Section 10 provides that the right of individual privacy is essential to the well-being of a free society and shall not be infringed without the showing of a compelling state interest.
That's right from the Constitution you're reading.
Yes,
okay.
Our Montana Constitution, which I might say is a provision that is unique to the state constitution. The federal constitution does not have an explicit right to privacy.
Okay, and then the right to know?
The right to know is Article 2, Section 9 of the Montana Constitution, and it says, no person shall be deprived of the right to examine documents or to observe the deliberations of all public bodies or agencies of state government and its subdivisions, except in cases in which the demand of individual privacy clearly exceeds the merits of public disclosure. So again, the words there with compelling state interest and when the demand of privacy exceeds the merits of public disclosure, those phrases invite review and exercise of judgment to determine how they should be applied in a given case.
Let me just summarize the facts in the case. The City of Billings disciplined 5 employees for inappropriate computer usage, accessing pornographic images on their work computers, but they declined to release the names and details about the investigation, and Billings Gazette said, we want the information. So what did the court decide and why?
Well, by the time the case got to us, most of the information had been released to the Gazette, with the exception of the names and positions of the 5 individuals. So that was the issue before the court, was whether those employees had an actual expectation of privacy that was protected by the Constitution, or whether the citizens, through the Billings Gazette, had a right to access that information under the right to know.
All right, and the court held?
The court held that the employees did have a protectable privacy interest in their identities in this situation.
And there was a split decision.
Correct. And the majority, of which I was a member, concluded that society would be willing to accept as reasonable a public employee's expectation of privacy in his or her identity with respect to what was an internal disciplinary matter. And the key to the decision was that it wasn't an issue of a position of public trust or a breach of the public trust involving the employee's work conduct, and the misconduct was a violation of the employer's policy, but it wasn't a criminal offense or related to the employee's position of public trust. So the court distinguished another recent case where the court had required disclosure in a case involving another City of Billings employee that allowed that employee to spend government money. Mm-hmm. And the employee had misused the government credit card to purchase items of a personal nature. And in that case, the court did hold that the disciplinary review of that employee was to be made public because the very misconduct in which the employee had engaged was the breach of the position of public trust she held for the city, which was spending of public funds. The distinguishing characteristics include that the more public trust you hold, the more diminished your expectation of privacy is. And so, for example, law enforcement officers in several cases have been held not to have privacy expectations where other citizens might because of the nature of their positions, or especially elected officials. We've had several cases where information regarding the misconduct or alleged misconduct of elected officials has been held public because the citizens are their boss and are entitled as their supervisor to have information about what they're doing in public office, even in cases where it may not relate to something they did in public office. For example, a case involving a county commissioner who had a DUI, even though the DUI was not committed while the person was performing an official function, because that person was an elected official, the court held that she didn't have an expectation of privacy even in some of her personal conduct.
So in overly simplified terms, let me just see if I picked up something that you said. Part of judging the person's right to privacy is if the court decides under the combination of circumstances they have a legitimate expectation of privacy.
Yes.
And then the public's right to disclosure has, in this sort of personnel case, one of the factors is the degree to which the job involves the public trust.
Correct. And whether there's a compelling interest in public disclosure. And in this Billings Gazette case, the court ruled that because the public already had received most of the information, including the discipline that was imposed, there wasn't a compelling interest just in learning the identity of the employees.
You're listening to Home Ground, and I'm Brian Kahn. We're talking with Beth Baker, Justice of the Montana Supreme Court, about the job and the Constitution. The second case I'd like to discuss with you was highly interesting for me to read. It's called Big Sky Colony, Inc. versus Montana Department of Labor and Industry, and let me see if I can do a simple summary. The legislature passed specific legislation requiring that Hutterite colonies, as entities engaged in agricultural production, participate in the workers' compensation system. They sued, saying it was an infringement on their free exercise of religion, a fundamental constitutional right.
Well, I think the one thing that perhaps to clarify is that the law didn't specify the Hutterite religion. It specified a religious corporation or entity that engages in commercial activity. In other words, receives remuneration from outside parties.
Okay, like selling, in this case, agricultural products.
Yes.
Split decision, 4-3. You were in the majority. What was the central argument that you guys concluded made this a legitimate statute?
The central issue was whether the Hutterite colonies had been singled out because of their religious views. And the court determined that the workers' compensation system was a system that was applicable to all commercial employers. And the amendment that brought in the Hutterite colony was not done for the purpose of singling out the religious exercise, but to make clear that when a religious entity engages in commercial activity, it then becomes subject to generally applicable non-religious laws that govern other commercial activity.
I read the decision carefully, and as a citizen, I was quite taken with the dissent's argument. The majority had said that the impact was not, I will say, central to religious activity. It didn't preclude religious activity. It was simply almost an accounting process. The dissent made a couple of points. The first was that this is a religious doctrine with communal implications that are fundamental, that people give up their rights to property as a part of being Hutterite, and two, that the legislative history in fact made clear it was written for specifically Hutterite activity. And therefore, the minority concluded this was in fact an infringement on religious liberty, both the practice of Hutterites and inappropriate, I will call it, targeting. Is that a fair summary of the dissent, would you say?
I think it is. I think that the difference in the two opinions came down to whether the law targeted a group because of its religious beliefs or whether the law was a generally applicable law that encompassed a church organization that competed in the workforce and was equally subject to the workers' compensation laws that apply to other employers.
This was not an opinion authored by you, correct?
No, it was then Justice Morris.
How do you size it up? Those are the serious arguments on both sides, a fundamental issue of religious liberty, and at the same time, someone saying you shouldn't get special treatment if you're a religious organization doing business like somebody else. How do you deal with that?
These are tough cases, and I think, as shown by the 4-3 split, there are cases on which reasonable, intelligent people can disagree. And we don't have time to talk about the whole opinion, but both opinions, and in particular the majority opinion, discusses a number of U.S. Supreme Court and federal court cases that ultimately the court determined were persuasive and decided the issue because the court determined that this case was similar. The process is that we start the case by reading the briefs that are submitted by the parties and their lawyers, and then we review the cases that are cited. In this case, we had oral argument, which means the lawyers come and answer questions from the court, present arguments about the authorities in support of their position.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have a preliminary discussion among ourselves to see where everybody is, talk about the law and what's persuasive. We discuss the points on both sides. And I can't recall in this particular case exactly how it went, but oftentimes we'll then go back and say, I want to look at this a little bit more. So we each look at the other cases. We come back and have more discussions. And finally, we take a preliminary vote so the Chief Justice can assign the writing responsibility.
If there's a split, does he assign who writes the dissent and the majority opinion or just the majority? How does that work?
He will assign who writes the majority opinion. And then the dissenting justices will talk among themselves, and one of us, if we're in the dissent, will volunteer to write the first draft of the dissent. Sometimes the majority opinion is circulated and the votes change, and then the author of the majority ends up authoring the dissent. So, and it's a fluid process. The opinion will be drafted, and that takes sometimes weeks, sometimes even months, depending on the complexity of the case. And a draft will be distributed to all members of the court who are participating in the case. People will make comments, add suggestions, ask the author to change a particular part or say, well, I could go along with you this far, but I'm not sure about these paragraphs, that sort of thing.
So it's pretty detailed interaction.
Yes.
You just said something I think is worth emphasis, that you rely on, and the briefs rely on, precedential cases on the same issue, whether it's Montana Supreme Court or the United States Supreme Court.
Yes.
And I noticed in this case, it cited the Lemon case, which I think is a U.S. Supreme Court decision, which establishes a basic rule and is summarized in this decision of your court as follows. The government conduct at issue must, one, have a secular purpose, and two, not have as its principal or primary effect inhibiting religion, and three, not foster excessive entanglement with religion. Clearly, those principles evolved over time in the body of constitutional law, correct?
Yes.
It wasn't there in the beginning when it's just a free exercise, Congress shall make no law, blah,
yeah,
blah, blah.
In fact, and that test applies to the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment.
Shall make no law establishing a religion. Elsewhere in the opinion, it cited an example of that. The court, and I think this was federal, U.S. Supreme Court, upheld the denial of a religion's right to use peyote in ceremonies because it was in violation of federal drug law, even though peyote was part of the religious worship process of a particular religion. Fair?
Right.
I just should say to the listeners, if you ever are interested in this, get copies of these opinions. They are obtainable easily on the web, and they make terrific reading because you really do hear both sides of very thoughtful arguments about your constitutional rights and how they apply in specific circumstances.
That's right. We have a great website, courts.mt.gov.
And they can find them there.
All the opinions, all the pending cases, and much more.
Third case is a criminal appeals case where a man that I will describe as having a really obnoxious history of violent conduct and sexual abusive behavior comes before the court, and it relates to whether or not testimony about his prior convictions and charges against him for similar behavior could be admitted in his trial. It had been admitted in district court, and his attorneys appealed and said the evidence of his prior alleged criminal activities should not have been part of the record that the jury considered. Fair summary?
Pretty fair.
Okay. Court's decision was unanimous, and what and why?
In that case, the court unanimously decided that the conviction had to be reversed, and I think a key factor in the case was that the prosecutor had asked the defendant just how many women he had been convicted of raping, and that brought out one particular case in which the defendant's conviction had actually been reversed. And because a criminal defendant is entitled by the Constitution to be judged on the acts that are with which he's charged
in that trial,
deprived him of a fair trial because the court determined, and this is really summarizing a lot in a very short sentence, but the court determined that the error likely affected the jury's decision to convict him, and we could not say that it had no effect on the conviction. It was improper evidence. That's in contrast to most cases where this issue of other crimes comes up often. But just to give an example of how it can be used, other bad acts may be used to show lack of mistake or accident or a defendant's motive. So in another recent case where a defendant was charged with soliciting a minor for sexual activity over the internet, his defense was that he thought the person he was chatting with over the internet was an adult, but the state was allowed to introduce records that he had in fact sought out other minors on internet websites.
Which goes to his motive?
It goes to lack of mistake, that he perhaps really didn't believe he was talking to an adult.
So that to a layperson, that sounds like maybe an important or unimportant detail, but clearly from the court standpoint, I'm hearing you say you can get in evidence of past conduct if it fits certain legitimate trial purposes that don't prejudice a jury inappropriately.
Right. The whole point is that a defendant cannot be convicted because he's a bad person.
He or she has to be convicted because of the act that is charged in that criminal indictment.
Right. Proof beyond a reasonable doubt.
Another case that struck me involved parental rights of custody. Can you summarize that?
Yes, that was a case in which the parents had divorced when their one child was quite young, 2 or 3 years old, and they had agreed to a custody arrangement that allowed the child to live with the mother until he reached the sixth grade, spend summers with his dad, and then at that point it would switch and the child would live with his dad during the school year and spend summers with mom. Mother sought to right before the child was set to enter the sixth grade, the mother requested that it be modified and said that because of difficulties the child had had in school and changes in the family, she thought he should attend or stay with her. The district court agreed and the Supreme Court reversed.
Now, the Supreme Court overrides a district court on where the child should go. Someone might say, who knows best?
Right, and it actually ended up being a 4-3 decision. And I think the reason the case is important for listeners is just to know that this is not a big constitutional case. This is a case involving two parents and a child, and yet it engendered a significant disagreement between the court, and the decision was to reverse the district court because the parents had made an agreement and the law requires a change in circumstances in order to undo that kind of parenting agreement.
And you were on the majority or minority?
No, I authored the dissent in that case.
In a nutshell,
it is the Supreme Court has no business deciding where a child attends the sixth grade. The district judge, the test under the law is the best interests of the child. And in my view, the district judge who talked to the parents, interviewed the child, listened to the witnesses, had the right to make that call.
Most states have an intermediary level of appeals courts. Montana doesn't. You go right from the district court to the Supreme Court. You had 860 filings, 360 or 380 opinions last year. Someone might say, and I think I'm among them, that having some sort of specialization, perhaps an intermediary appeals court or something like a family court, as we have drug courts, could both enhance the expertise of courts in certain appeals and reduce the workload of the Supreme Court. Is that a crazy idea? Not? What do you think?
Well, Brian, I have to say I feel strongly about that both ways. I think that an intermediate appellate court, we are unusual. There's only maybe one or two other states that have no intermediate appellate court. It makes sense for the reasons you discussed, that because of the caseload, you do have to make, I think the hardest part of my job is giving adequate time to every case. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, our court is caught up in workload right now, whereas our district courts are absolutely overwhelmed. The greatest need in our court system right now is at the district court level. So it's difficult to justify the resources that would be needed to add an intermediate appellate court in Montana.
Someone might say, in matters of justice, since it's the second provision in the preamble to the United States Constitution, that money shouldn't be the deciding question here.
Well, as you know, it's not the courts that set the budget for the judicial branch of government. It's the legislature, which has to balance the competing needs of all the branches of government. And I think that those are issues for another show, probably. But in any event, I think that there is a serious need to make sure our courts are adequately handling the matters brought to them. And right now, the bigger demand is at the trial level.
Montana Supreme Court Justice Beth Baker, I very much regret to say we're out of time. I want to thank you so much for being with us on Home Ground.
It's been a real pleasure. Thank you, Brian.
And to our listeners, many thanks for being with us. We hope you'll join us next week. Home Ground is an independent production of Artemis Common Ground and does not necessarily reflect the views of this radio station. Post-production by Valtron Recording Studios. We welcome your ideas for new programs at www.homegroundradio.org. Home Ground is made possible by grants from the Liz Claiborne Art Ortenberg Foundation, Cinnabar Foundation, Humanities Montana, and the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication about issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans.